Welcome to the Kate and Colby Show,
where we talk about things that matter,
practice the art of coming more alive,
and reflect on just how strange and wonderful life can be.
We're glad you're here. Well, good evening, friends.
Hi, everyone.
Gentle people. Welcome to the Kate and Colby Show with me, Colby, and you.
Kate and Belle.
And it turns out the dog's here tonight.
Yeah,
we got a pod dog in the house here in the Kate and Colby Show.
She's just too sweet to say no to. She wanted to say hi.
Oh, is that what it is? Too sweet to say no to? I don't have that problem. No.
I do. Ugh.
Why do you like dog breath?
Yes.
It is not the best. I can think of literally
like
423 things that I like smelling better than that.
It smells like
coffee,
love.
Chocolate, roses, beer.
Roses. You don't like the smell.
I like roses better than dog breath. This is 100% accurate. Hey, on tonight's show, in addition to more of this, whatever this is, we're going to be joined by our dear friend, the one, the only, as far as I know, Richard Beck. And I can't wait to talk to him about his brand new book, Hunting Magic Eels.
You've been so excited about this. I basically can't wait to sit here and watch you two chat.
Because
you've been so excited. I'm just going to let you be excited and just watch.
I of devoured this book.
You have.
Absolutely of devoured it.
Yeah.
So I can't wait to talk to him about that. Anyway, all that and more on the Kate and Colby Show tonight. Welcome. We're glad you're here.
I tried to put her down, and then she wrapped her arms around me and gave me a bigger hug. That is too sweet to say no to.
It's not.
Look at her paws. Look at the way she just wraps them around my neck. And it up with those there. She's just the sweetest.
I'm really happy for you, babe. Also, Kelsey Ziegler is happy for you. She says, hi, sweet Belle. Hi, Kelsey. So glad you're here.
Belle.
Oh, and Kate and Colby. You got the hi before we did. Glad to have you here tonight. Benaya, thanks for joining us.
Yay.
Shane, love that you're here. We've got a first-time watcher tonight. Everybody say hi, Eva.
Hi, Eva.
Hey,
love that you're here. Hey, Hartman 23. Welcome back. Glad you're here. Hey, Lauren. Thanks. I am rocking the shirt. We were commenting during the countdown there.
We clash. I'm wearing root beer color and Colb's wearing like real true red.
Yeah.
It doesn't look good together. Fun fact, lately, every time we see each other for the first time in the day, we start busting up laughing because we've somehow accidentally matched.
We strangely matched.
Entirely matched.
A lot.
Like yesterday. Was it yesterday? We were wearing the exact same outfit.
Yeah.
Like the exact.
Like army green.
Same outfit.
Short sleeve shirt, black bottoms. It was just. Anyway.
The exact same outfit.
So we're not doing that tonight. We're just.
And then today we.
You've got dog hair all over you. But
is that too?
Pet hair. Pet hair is much for me. Hello, Susan. So glad that you're here. Hi, James, Seamus.
Okay, I have a question for the peeps since we're saying hi to them.
Yeah.
Thank you. I love my tats, too.
Victor loves your tats.
And I want more of them. Someday we'll do a, like, tattoo story time.
Someday.
What was I going to ask? Oh, are y'all grossed out by pet hair? Like, Colby finds it to be gross, like a gross thing. Like, barf. Like, that would make me say...
Just real quick. Just real quick.
You are such a dork.
Oh, they even has an animal one on the screen.
Really
that's hilarious. We're not going to do the whole segment, but just on this one, whose team are you on?
I just brought
How do you
it
feel
up
about
because
pet hair?
It was coming to my attention, and you hit the bumper to make the whole scene run.
A bumper up to
anyway,
you.
I just want to know because, you know, like, there's things that are disgusting, boogers, puke.
This conversation.
There's things that are gross, garbage, this conversation. But Colby finds dog hair or cat hair to be in that, and I don't, like, I legit can't even explain it right now because I don't understand so, like,
it doesn't
what you mean.
It doesn't bother
you. I mean, I don't like that I'm covered in dog hair, but I'm not like, ew. It's not an ew. You know, if you think of Inside Out, like the gross
disgust,
mm-hmm. like my disgust character isn't coming online because of pet hair. I just go, oh my gosh, there's a lot of pet hair. I got to clean it up. But you go, ew, gross.
My disgust
gross.
And anger are equally like, cleanse me of those, all unrighteousness.
Do those two come online together? Do they, because you know, certain feelings like come together and does disgust feel angry to you?
Oh, interesting. You know who we should ask about? I'll respond in a second, but our guest tonight, Richard Beck, wrote an entire book on disgust.
Are you serious?
One of my favorite books he's ever written. It's called Unclean. And I think I've made like four sermons out of
his
concept of disgust. So does disgust trigger anger for me? I think in this case it does. Yes, that's correct. It does.
Are you all grossed out by hair?
Okay.
What have we got?
The people are responding to this. Okay. Susan says
pet hair is an accessory.
I'm offended by that comment, actually. Victor says, this show's brought to you by Lint Hair Removers. I like that. Eva, a little is okay. So that's Team Kate.
Is Eva our new
viewer? Yeah. So Eva. You have two votes. Don't hug me at church. Then, LOL, we have three cats and a hug. Okay.
Oh, Alexa, God, Husky. Not be.
We are
that's
red,
a lot of hair.
You and me, red sticker forever. So that's three. Hey, Ben, I got Ben. Team Cal, wait. Maybe Ben's combining
us. That's our two names put together. I don't know what that means.
I'm taking it. I used to spell my name with the K. Shane's like, not that gross out, but I wouldn't want a clump of it and decorate the wall with it.
Well, me neither, but it doesn't gross me out.
Hey, like, Benaya. I got one. Dog puke is worse.
Oh, see, then Shane followed up Team Kate, I think. Yeah, because you're not like grossed out. I'm not going to decorate my walls with it either.
Eva's like, it's annoying, but not disgusting.
Yeah, see, exactly. That's, yeah, I just, the grossed out factor is what surprises me every time you do your big ew. I just don't get why it's gross. But.
Okay. More people are with you. Kate wins this.
Oh,
which is
interesting.
Not a,
I'm actually surprised.
Really?
Yeah. Because.
Now you can talk through those. These are just the visual transitions. You can.
He bumper ups me. That's what my friend Karen affectionately named it when we're talking, and all of a sudden Colby hits a button and the bumper runs. He bumper upped me. Anyway, that's just fascinating. I'm surprised that people feel the same way as me about it. It's just like, yeah.
Well, speaking of how people are feeling, while their digis are all warmed up and they're ready to respond, let's do a quick viewer check-in, all right? So this is where you grab your bass guitar.
I co-opted Hope's plan for the night with a question about gross things.
No, you got it warmed up. I love it. The topic for tonight is...
You are kidding me. I have to put this up. That's got to be a joke. There are people, that, people that knit with cat hair. Like, make things, like, knit with it. I mean, I guess that's what all yarn is.
I'm not going to recover.
Well,
I'm,
no,
I'm
when
dead.
You think about it, see?
When you think, I don't want to think about it. I have stopped thinking about it. I've moved on.
Okay.
Okay, magic. What's all y'all's feelings and posture and attitude about magic? Do you love it? Do you loathe it? Oh, my God, so annoying. Are you curious about how magic works and how magicians do their tricks? Are you frustrated by it because you don't know? Do you have, like, a general indifference toward it? What are your feels about magic? Tell me everything you want about magic. Do you have favorite magicians? Do you have a favorite show? You have a show that you told the show, the Kate and Colby show about it a while, right after we watched it. Incredible. One of the best magical experiences ever. But,
I still haven't caught up to what you're talking about.
Oh, you haven't? Great. What's it called? It's the one you had Zeke watch. Derek Delgado. Is that because you don't think of it as magic show?
Yes, that's exactly why.
It's magic, babe. He does magic.
What is it called?
What is that called? It was like life-changing.
Why are we both just completely blanking? Anyway. Yeah, that's why I didn't think of it, because it wasn't magic. It was actually, that's ridiculous that I just said that. It was a transformative experience, which is magic.
Which is magic.
So yes, it was magical.
Yes.
But my mind went somewhere else, and therefore I thought you were trying to think of like a fantasy show that I watch.
Oh,
like
no.
That, like I went, my mind went that
way. Got you. Not like Harry Potter magic.
Gotcha.
This is real magic.
Oh, I'm sorry. Are you distinguishing between the two?
This is real magic.
Colb likes to tease at our house about this whole topic.
I love magic. I could watch magic shows and magicians doing their
Someone
card
in the
tricks
comments,
and their
please
illusion.
Remind us what that is called. Derek Delgado.
I'm a sucker for all of it. And I both really, really want to know how they do the things, and also really am glad I don't know.
Oh, yeah, you do feel
you know what I mean?
Both
I'm like,
that,
I
yes.
really, really want to know.
Yes.
But then when I know, it's like, oh, shoot, I kind of wish I didn't know. I kind of wish the magic was still alive. But then sometimes finding out how the tricks are done is quite the joy.
In and of itself.
Duh. In and of itself?
Yes.
One of the best things you should watch.
Everybody should just stop what they're doing and go. I'm not telling people to leave the Kate and Colby show, but you have to go watch that after this, after our show.
Feel the same. Yes, David Blaine. David Blaine is not of this world. I don't know from whence he came from. He's I don't know where he came from.
Favorite moments. Yeah.
I don't know about the Magician series. I haven't watched it, though. So.
Oh, really?
But I'm glad to know you like it, Bill. Also, hi, Bill.
People,
good to see you.
People are really into this question that you are asking, which I find
fascinating.
Magic
the Gathering? I wondered if somebody
Generally
thinks, Kaylee.
Nice.
Closest to clowns? Ben, them are fighting words. A, I like clowns. And two, no,
you
magic
do.
Is not.
People are clowns. So weirded out when they find that out about you, yeah. that you have a collection of clowns that you love.
Victor was picking up my Mr. Rogers.
It is
vibe
gay,
on that
it?
Transition.
One of our children today, I realized, is Mr. Rogers. They even come home from school and take off of their school sweater and put on their at-home sweater.
They do, don't they?
I'm not joking.
It's so adorable. I never
Immediately,
thought of that.
They walk through the door, they take off their school sweater, they put it away, and they put on their at-home sweater. Talk about magic.
That's really freaking adorbs.
Okay, so I find this question fascinating, endlessly fascinating, because are there really people, and I guess we're finding out in the comments, that have different feelings? I thought, like, everybody just loves magic. But you're saying there's folks who loathe it, there's folks who get frustrated by it, there's folks who are indifferent to it?
I don't know.
Okay.
So here's my hypothesis, mm-hmm. is that everybody, you always got your outliers, whatever.
Sure.
Everybody likes magic. Some people love it. So like the baseline.
So you're just trying to.
I'm trying to figure out where.
Lovers out there.
I don't know that there's loathers out there. I don't know if people are like, oh, I just hate. You know, like Pete Holmes has that joke about the guy who just like sits in the magic show, like fake. You know, it's like,
yeah.
Not real. Like, well, yeah. Duh. Obviously it's not real. None of it's real.
Yes. And. Again, go watch it in and of itself. Eva, I think that that's part of the question and part of the discussion. So Eva was like, oh, I was typing that. Then I realized you were talking about show magic. And then I thought you were talking, and she said, I thought you were talking about the magic we were raised to stay away from. As an example, astrology, tarot, etc. LOL. I share your LOL. And I think the whole point is kind of, what are we talking about? What is magic, uh-huh. right? That's kind of the question.
Yeah.
What is magic? It all is. That's why we keep going, not real. Yes, it is. And it's just
the like the subtitle for our guest book tonight is Recovering. You got to cover your
it's
eyes.
Not focusing. No.
It just really likes. No, keep. Stay. You were good.
I was trying. You know.
There it is. Recovering an Enchanted Faith in a Skeptical Age.
Such a good subtitle.
Which is to say we have become, you might say, a society that has done away with magic. And I think it has trickled into.
I think we might have overcorrected with our kids.
We might have.
Our kids would be like, how does the faucet work? And we would go, magic. And that was our answer to absolutely
Our youngest kid
everything.
Right now always responds with, no, science. It's not magic, it's science. Well, sure. But now he's at the point where he can actually explain the science.
Yeah.
Dad, do you want to know how that works? As I turn on the electric griddle. Do you know how that works? No. Do you want to know? Yeah. Will you understand if I tell you? Probably not.
That's the new question all the time for us with our kids.
He's a 9-year-old electrician. He's awesome.
If I explain this to you, will you understand
even
it?
Understand it.
Hurts a little bit.
Whatever happened to Chris Angel? That's a good question. I'm not entirely sure.
I forgot that human sure. existed.
Okay, so here's an opinion. Benaya says, it's fascinating to see, but I don't particularly care for it. So I would put that in the indifference category.
Yeah.
So thanks for your vulnerability.
Yeah.
He might have typed that before I made the comment about everybody likes it. Yeah.
Are you putting Benina in the outliers category? Yes. We love our outliers.
We do,
especially me. All right. Enneagram 4.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bill Pitts, explain it to me, Huck.
Right.
I know all of us. All of us need to know. Sweet.
Like,
thanks for checking in with us, viewers.
We tore the living room apart the other day, and you got some new cool speakers, and you had the receiver. Wasn't it the receiver that was sitting
there? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Huck was over there just studying the inside of the sound receiver thingy system. See, that's how much I know about this stuff, because I call them thingies. And Huck was, like, gasping and saying all these fancy big words. And I was like, what are you so excited about, buddy? Well, would you understand it? No, Mama wouldn't.
That's
but I'm glad you're excited.
The biggest conducer I've ever seen.
Yeah. It's pretty sweet.
That's fun. Well, hey, all before right, we friends. Get to our guest, can we just remind you that if you want, we
this
invite you to support.
This is my favorite music that you use in your show. And that noise.
Just how it falls off at the end there. Hey, if you want to support the Kate and Colby Show, there's a number of ways for you to do that. You could, for example, go follow us on Instagram at Kate and Colby. You could sign up for our newsletter, which doesn't get sent out very often. But every time I do, I think, God bless all the people who said, thank you for that. One day, that'll be our primary way of communicating with you.
I could do the newsletter.
That'd be fun. I'd love that. You want to do that?
Yes.
You would love that, too. You'd be really good at it.
I would love that. Yep. I love sending out newsletters.
Go subscribe to our podcast, because this is a podcast after all. Yes, we do the live show, but primarily it was and shall be a podcast.
It is.
That is also
still where most people hang out.
It is also 6 weeks behind because somebody. I got another lead today on a potential editor. So I've got two emails sent out because we're ready to because people have bought, this is a fun tie-in, because people have bought us coffees, which is the other way to support us, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/Kate and Colby and support the show financially. Because people have been doing that, we're now in a position where we're like, I think we can outsource the post-production of the show.
Which means that we won't be 6 weeks behind.
I was reading an article.
Pod fam, we love you. You're hearing this in, they'll be hearing this in October.
I don't know yet.
Happy Halloween, Pod fam. Happy Halloween.
I don't know yet. But I was reading an article the other day about how, thank you, about how money. About how money can't buy happiness, but it also can, mm-hmm. if you spend it on the right things. And one of the things that.
Do you remember when I told you all about that? Gretchen Rubin, she has a whole chapter in her book about money can't buy happiness, but it can.
Yeah.
Anyway, you read an article.
This is a different article that I'm sure has nothing to do with that. Wildly unconnected.
Yes.
I do this all the time. Kate tells me about things and then I
forget. I excitedly tell him something and then he's like.
I have a very shallow bowl for holding certain memories. They go in and they fall out rather quickly. And then I scoop them up if it's brand new ideas. And Kate's like, babe, that's been.
I know. I told you that.
Bowl
four
of memory
ago.
For a long ass time.
Anyway.
Anyhoozle. One of the ways you can spend your money that can bring happiness is to buy yourself time, which is to say, pay someone to mow the yard for you, right?
Yes.
Or in this case, pay someone to edit the podcast for you. So that would make us very happy to have a podcast regularly edited. And it would make me happy to not do it because I'm a little bit under the water of doing it right now. So anyway, buymeacoffee.com/Kate and Colby if you want to support the show. You can do one-time coffees like, hey, thanks for the show tonight. It was great. Have a couple coffees. Or you can become monthly baristas.
Okay, Shane says, just don't let it be Merry Christmas.
It's fine if it is. We'll do our best. Thank you. We have monthly baristas such as Bill and Patty who have said, hey, we love you, we support you. Here's monthly coffees, and we wanted just a shout out to them and say thank you. Okay, that's it for that. Another, let's go back to Mr. Rogers. Victor, we also accept coffee emojis. Thank you.
Aww.
That works. We receive.
Thank you.
Let's get to our guest, shall we?
Yeah.
Come on, bring it. Good evening, dear friend.
Yay.
Sir Richard,
it's good to see you guys.
Oh my gosh!
Welcome.
Isn't it fun to see each other? Because I don't know about you, but we really like you. I'm not going to presume to say you like us, but it's fun for us to see you because we really like you.
It's been years.
I have been fans of yours for a long time, and it's been a while, so it is good to be on the show.
Yeah. Yay.
I love the dog hair conversation. I was pondering who I'm with on
that. Yeah. Yeah. What's your gut reaction? Where do you fall?
I'm with Kate.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll be fine.
It's okay. I'll be fine.
Can you, real quick though, let's stay here for a second because you are the king of disgust in my mind. I'm sure other people have talked about
that
disgust.
That was funny that you
I
made
know,
that
like
connection.
He has written so much about the disgust response. So is it normal for that disgust in me to trigger anger? Are those often connected, or is it just sort of sometimes it kind of depends on what activates the disgust response?
I mean, they're different emotions. I think you're angry at somebody bringing you into contact with something you find disgusting.
Okay.
Wait, does that make sense?
I'm the somebody.
Wait, right. You're disgusted by the dog hair. You're angry at Kate.
Yes. Thank you. I just feel like that did more for our marriage therapy than like 18 years of actual therapy. All we needed was for someone to say, "You're mad at Kate."
That is not where
and,
I saw
and he was turning into like a theological problem. You know, like it was really difficult.
Oh my God, stop. I can't.
This is not where I saw this conversation going. Well, that's all the time we have tonight, Richard. Thanks for stopping by.
I'm happy to help, you know.
All right.
So many things right there. In
okay.
That. How are you?
I'm good.
How's it going?
Things are good.
Yeah.
Things are good.
It's
yeah.
Been a hell of a
no,
year
it's
and
been
a half.
It's been a crazy yeah. It's been a crazy year, but I'm a college professor and the semester started, so it was good to be back with students again. So
are you
families
in person
well.
For
yeah.
That?
Yeah, we are. So I'm in Texas, right? So the coronavirus doesn't exist here.
Okay.
That's
good.
Lucky you.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't know what anybody's worried about. So we were face to face last year, but masked and socially distanced.
Yeah.
So it's a little different from California, but
yeah,
we're face-to-face.
Yeah, okay.
So just for context, for those who are meeting you for the first time, you are a professor of psychology at Abilene Christian University. Yep, and you've been doing that work for how long? How long now have you been psychologizing on a professorial
level? Yeah, it's been a long
level.
Time, like over 20 years now I've been teaching and writing psychology. But my area of interest in research and writing has been like psychology of religion, which is kind of why I wrote that disgust book, you know, because that whole thing in the Bible about people being unclean.
Yeah.
So I was using psychology to kind of understand what does it mean to kind of treat people as untouchable, how that affects the church and how we treat people we might classify as sinners. And I think still to this day, it's like the best thing I've ever written. Like most people, when they know me, it's usually from that book.
Yeah. It's so good. I remember being introduced to this idea, how in that sort of culture, the transference of cleanliness only ever went one way. It went from you sort of start as clean and then you become unclean, right? By behaviors or by certain illnesses or by failure to perform particular rituals. And then along comes this joker, Jesus, who dares suggest that one can reverse the transference and actually be like, no, you are not unclean. And that framework I found really fascinating. Was that something that you kind of developed on your own, or was that something you'd come across in various pieces? Do you remember? I know that was a long time ago, and that's not really why you're here, but.
No. I think the idea was my own, but I've since found other people kind of make that connection that the way contagion works is that if you would have, like back in Bible times, if you touched a leper, let's say, then that would have made you contaminated. But obviously throughout the Gospels, Jesus is touching lepers all the time and reversing that direction. And that's just a highly counterintuitive idea, the idea that a holy person embraces the sinner, right? A holy person, a pure person, runs towards the unclean. There's something in our wiring that I think goes back to kind of the evolved nature of a disgust response that wants us to pull away. And so to behave like Jesus is kind of crossing your emotional wires, you know, practicing approaching when maybe your entire religious tradition and even your own gut is saying withdraw. He's saying approach and embrace. And I think that it takes a while to learn that lesson. But if we don't learn it, you see all the kind of catastrophic things in Christian traditions where people have kind of a quarantine logic. I'll just retreat into this tribe of the pure and the holy and stand in judgment of the world. You know, and Jesus seemed to, if he got hot and bothered, it was usually with those kinds of people. You know, he would call out that behavior more than he would call out the sinners of his day. Like my favorite line, like if you had to quote my favorite Jesus verse, is when he looks at the religious leaders of his day and he says, hey, the sex workers and the tax collectors get into the kingdom of heaven before you do. Like that's pretty wild.
That's absurd.
You know, yeah. The prostitutes and the tax collectors are going to get in before you church people. Yeah, that's, I don't know if we've really kind of internalized how radical that idea is.
Why does that still give me chills? Why does that still make me teary? Why does that still make me go, like, mind blown?
Yeah. Isn't that the paradox, though? Like we find Jesus so beautiful. We find that kind of radical witness of love, like, the most compelling thing. And I think a lot of us that have been on the edges of Christianity are still hanging on. Like that's the only thing keeping us in the game is Jesus. But it's not easy to do that. I think that's the hard part is that if that would, and I've talked to lots of different faith communities about that. Like you see it every day on a bumper sticker where people just say like, be kind, like I saw this the other day, be a kind human. I'm like, would that it was so easy.
Right.
Like it seems easy, but then the radical kindness of Jesus is being kind to people that maybe you don't want to be kind to. And that's where we start, I think, getting tripped up, especially in a really politically polarized world. That's, kindness is a lost virtue, I think.
Do you think the sort of early church, so post-Jesus, do you think there was a time in which they really embodied that ethos? Because it feels like it didn't take long before, if they had it, they lost it, or maybe they never fully got it. Because the psychology of religion was so strong for them, the psychology of clean, unclean, even though you had these transformative moments of Peter seeing this vision of the sheet coming down and Paul being like, well, I mean, the Gentiles, they can be just as full of the Spirit as everyone else. And you see theologically the movement expand. Have you sort of ever looked into or seen, did they succeed for at least a generation of embodying this ethos before it kind of turned back in on itself to become this insular religion?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a church historian. I mean, I do know that the Roman critics of the church criticized the church for being a religion of basically slaves and women. Like a Roman elite looked at this little community and go like, hey, don't hang out with those people because that's a religion for slaves and women. And so I've always kind of hung my hat on that as kind of like, it seemed like they were doing something that was really cutting across kind of the honor shame ethos of that culture, and that they were elevating people on the shame part of the continuum, and that was what was attracting them, that their dignity was being seen and rehabilitated. And so, yeah, I think there was something there that caused, because one of the great paradoxes I think of the Christian movement is why it became so viral, to use right. that word, in the Roman Empire. Like, how did worshiping a crucified, you know, God, like, why would that be remotely attractive to anybody in that culture? And so I think it's still like an outstanding historical mystery about like what happened. But I have to think that there was something about Christianity that appealed to the very lowest people in that society. And wherever the gospel has gone, it's always found traction among the lowest strata of society. So I do think there's a deep attraction there. But yes, what happens is then, once Christianity gets co-opted by powerful interests, then it kind of replicates the you know, the honor code of the dominant society again. And then, so to me, I think the gospel is always like a moving target. Like the minute it's like music, the minute it becomes totally. Mainstream, it's not alternative anymore. And so you got to keep looking for the alternative artists who are getting Jesus right. And so Jesus is going to be busking in a subway, not what you're going to be hearing on the radio. And so you got to constantly be, yeah, I don't know if let's play with that metaphor, right? You got to be kind of like into indie artists and clubs and kind of figure out where the spirit is blowing.
I love that. That's part of why I still use the moniker Christian for myself, is because I'm still compelled by that story and because I was raised in it, it's in me. But I use the term progressive to describe it because it's like lines up with 21st century American progressive ideology. No, it's because there's a sense in which I think this, like, Jesus was progressive for his time, and now that would be pretty conservative in some context. So now it's like the goal, or one of the goals, like you said, is it always is moving, whether because we push it or because it's sort of just moves of its own accord. Mm-hmm. So we're always kind of chasing it in our own unique context. And I think that has this progressive nature to it, where it progresses and evolves and transforms. And I think that's spot on.
Yeah, it's exactly. I mean, our question was actually, you know, we both went to ask a question at the same time. We actually had the same exact question. Mine just came out, and why do I still get chills? Mm. But it's that. It's the same reason you get chills when you hear music that you know, feel like you've never heard before. It's, to use our music thing, like, it's the alternative music that's giving me chills, because it's still, we've just done the whole cycle again and are repeating history, and it's relevant today.
So that's a beautiful segue into your newest book, because my sense has been that for years now, there have been those who have found a sort of disillusionment with their religious heritage, with their Christian upbringing, and they have hit a point where they feel, they intuit, they have this sense that the thing needs to evolve, needs to progress. And so they go through this process of inspecting what they were given. I talk about it like a Jenga tower. They pull out the little blocks of all their beliefs, and they realize which ones they want to keep but maybe turn, which ones they want to throw away altogether. And they're kind of going through this evaluative process with their faith. But then what happens a lot of time is the thing that maybe gets built on the end is, you know, to straw man it for a minute, is really just like this secular humanism. Which isn't the way you can do worse than being a secular humanist. Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is true. Be kind is not a bad way to live. Like, if that's just what you do, that's not bad. But then for those who maybe keep going in that journey, they find a gap, maybe a sadness or a missingness of, like,
something's missing.
There's something missing. Maybe secular humanism's good for 18 months. But months 19 through 24 starts to feel dissatisfied. And that has been, in my own way, a bit of my own journey. And then with our work with our church, we've seen that journey so many times. So then enter Hunting Magic Eels. Can you please, before we get into the book, can you please, A, tell us what the title is all about? And then two, what led you to put this thing together? Why did you write this book?
Yeah. So the title, the first line of the book is, we were hunting magic eels, and the publisher thought that would be an intriguing title, and so we went with that. Nice. And so I tell the story at the beginning of the book. We're in Wales and visiting Sanwyn Island, looking for an enchanted well, like a water well, from the Abbey of St. Dwynwen. And St. Dwynwen is like the St. Valentine's of Wales. And she's the St. Valentine's because her well had these magical eels in it, these enchanted eels. And the legend was, if you threw a token of your lover in, like a handkerchief of your love, into the well, and the eels disturbed it, that was then a sign that your lover would be faithful for life. And so obviously a lot of magic eel tourism And pilgrimages emerged as people wanted to travel to this well to kind of get the verdict on whether or not this love would be faithful to me. And so we were there looking for this well. It's not there anymore. Mm. It's a ruin. But I kind of take that as a metaphor for what has happened about religious faith over the last 500 years, where 500 years ago, people are making pilgrimages to get marital advice from magical eagles. And we don't live in that world anymore. So mm-hmm. a world that seemed stuffed with supernatural wonders, from saints to miracles to God to demons to angels to witches and ghosts and elves and all like that magical enchanted world. You know, we live in a world like where your son is asking you questions like, I could explain this to you, but will you understand it?
Yes.
You know, like, yep. we're living a science technological world. And so we're seeing just the rise of atheism and agnosticism, the rise of the nuns, people not affiliating with Christianity anymore, don't know if they believe it. And even the faithful, like people still sitting in the pews, you know, faith feels fragile now. It feels provisional, contestable now. So even amongst the faithful, faith feels, like we can opt out of it. We can choose not to believe in God. So the book was written to kind of talk about like why that has happened to us and then what do we do next? Because a lot of us kind of get to that last shred of doubt and we're kind of hanging on. And this book was written to kind of try to help somebody maybe kind of turn their hearts back towards God and see God, see that sacred, holy thing that's sitting right in front of you if you have the eyes to see it.
You've got this great line in the, I think, either chapter one or chapter two where you say, God may be dead, but we sure do miss him. I underline that. And I just think that's so succinctly put this feeling that, well, I'll just be vulnerable for a minute, this feeling that I've had for a couple of years now. And I was doing a live conversation with a guy named Sean McDowell. He's the son of Josh McDowell, who wrote, I can't remember if you grew up in evangelical world, but in evangelical world, there was a book called Evidence That Demands a Verdict by Josh McDowell. And it was this mm-hmm. apologetics masterpiece, you know? And his son, Sean, has, you know, developed a platform and invited me on to do his conversation. And he was super charitable and gracious. That's not anti-Sean at all. But in the conversation, I shared kind of vulnerably with the people that were watching it with Sean that, you know, because I was trying to describe progressive Christianity as I see it and as I practice it. And I talked about how moving away from this idea of God as a single separate subject being that is out there somewhere that then occasionally like interacts with the world, moving away from that idea of God that as like this personal being that's out there has had an impact on me, which is to say, I have found myself missing. I miss that conception, even though I can't rationally really go there anymore. I miss that connection, that relational idea of this personal mm-hmm. being of a God. And so then when you read that, like, you know, God may be dead, but we sure do miss him. Like, yeah, that is. And then people sort of weaponized that against me, which was has been an interesting experience to have more conservative, traditional Christians latch on to me saying that and be like, ha, there's proof that that you have gone down the slippery slope, that you have abandoned the truth, like use that as the conviction of the Holy Spirit. I'm like, that's not really what I'm saying. That's not really what it is.
Yeah. No, I describe what has happened in the last 500 years as the mystical to moral shift. And what I mean by that is to your point, is that, you know, being a good person is hugely important to most of us. Like, we want to be on the right side of a social justice debate, right? We want to be for the oppressed. And what's interesting is how moralized the progressive imagination is. And so much so that some people would argue that much of progressive behavior on social media is performative morality, yeah. right? Virtue signaling yes. and things like that. But it shows how deeply invested we are on like getting it right.
Yes.
On race, on gender, on sexuality, on all the things. And yet, there is a part of being a human being that involves transcendence, not just moral performance, not just political activism. As necessary as those things are, we do need locations of transcendence. And by transcendence, as a psychologist, I'm talking about dashboard indicators like joy, a sense of grace that comes to you even when you don't like live up to your moral standards, peace and hope, right? These are kind of transcendent emotions that are not reducible to kind of a factual materialistic view of the world. And so that's what I mean by, you know, if God's dead, like as a cultural assumption, most people struggle to believe in God now, or many do. And yet without a transcendent part of our lives, what I call hallowing, making something sacred, life feels flat and purposeless. And we don't, the only thing we're living for is like the next Marvel movie, you know, like when's season two of Loki, you know, that's all my students care about, you know, is the next consumer product out in front of them rather than living a bigger story. And I think that's what Christianity has given many of us, mm-hmm. kind of a big story that doesn't just give me a moral compass, but it also gives me a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, a sense of hope, and also kind of a word that comes to me from outside my own neurosis that says, yeah, you might not be able to forgive yourself, but you are still forgiven. You know, a word of grace that some of us need, because otherwise you're just trapped in your own head trying to forgive yourself. And a lot of us kind of get stuck there. And God is that voice kind of outside your head that points you back to your true self.
You just described my insides. Like, I just feel like my story and my experience of life was just said out loud through Mr. Beck. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like, at first I wanted to argue with you and say, well, what if Loki is my sacred? But... Which there's some both and there, for sure. And, yeah, you went to a deeper truth that is absolutely my life, is I will get stuck in that just very rigid kind of just copying the conservative black and white space that we used to be in, but doing it over here in this one. And sure, may it have a better moral compass? Fine. But in the end, is it really? Because I'm just kind of meh about everything and not really doing or experiencing life. Anyway, I don't need to repeat it because you just put words to what I've experienced. That's been my journey.
Yeah, and the other thing is I often think some of these conversations get – one thing that frustrates me about conversations about religion is how they always get trapped in these false dichotomies. So it's like if you talk about transcendence, then somehow you're not also talking about social justice. Right. You know, like somehow those are pitted against each other. And like and so I kind of keep clarifying for people, like, no, I think like you're Colby said about like liberal humanists. Like, of course we would agree with liberal humanists because you believe in the dignity of every human being. Mm. You care about justice and rights and all of that. And like all of that you would say amen to. The question then is, but still on your dark nights or when your life has kind of hit a dead end, or you're in the midst of pain and suffering, like, are you alone or is there a love that kind of is going to always be there with you, like that divine presence? And I know the word God is problematic, but there is a longing for, you know, I'm trying to name an experience that we're all longing for, and we might have different understandings of it. And so I think you see this a lot though, in psychology research too, is that psychologists are kind of coming to the conclusion that we need transcendence in our life. You see it in simple practices like gratitude, where gratitude is like one of the best predictors of happiness that we have. Like it's the simplest therapy in the world to just say thank you for this thing right in front of you. Even if that's a child that's stressing you out or a spouse or a sunrise or a cup of coffee, but gratitude is a transcendent emotion because who are you saying thankful? Who are you being thankful? Like where's that thanks being offered? You know, just to the cosmos. To the mere practice of saying thank you is a posture of prayer.
Yeah.
Because you're just kind of looking outside your stuff out there and saying, you know, I don't know who's responsible for this, but thank you for this.
Can I do a quick story there? Quick story on that. speaking of Loki, the other show that people are waiting to see is Ted Lasso. So have you watched Ted Lasso? Are you familiar? Okay.
I love Ted Lasso.
Okay. So the actor Brett Goldstein, who plays the really sort of angry soccer player, right? He's one of the producer writers of the show as well. He was recently, it's the second time I've mentioned Pete Holmes tonight. He was recently on Pete Holmes' podcast, and they were, and he was sharing how Brett grew up sort of in Church of England, going to church, but then from, you know, adolescent, young adult, walked away, was an atheist for many, many years. And then Pete asked him, like, what changed? Because now he has, like, a faith practice again. And Brett said, I forget the story, but he was somewhere where it was just, there was this beautiful natural thing happening, sunset, sunrise, whatever it was. And he said, I immediately welled up with a sense of gratitude and realized that that needed to go somewhere. Like, he had that exact moment you're describing of overwhelmed gratitude and realizing, where is this going to go? Where does this go to? And it was in that moment that he decided to open back up to the possibility of transcendence, led to that by gratitude. So I love when you talk about those dashboard indicators of transcendence and, yeah, gratitude. Anyway, you can keep going, but I just got real excited that you
nailed it. That's exactly right. And those are like the most deeply human experiences that we have. And somehow in this scientific technological age, we've been told that those are feelings are false, right? They're leading you astray in superstition.
They're just firing synapses in your brain.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think if you just think about your life, you're like, no, that feeling I had, like he had, that's like, that's the truest thing in my life. That is a North Star for me. And I might unpack that in a different way from lots of people religiously, but we're talking about the same feelings.
Hmm. Yeah, we are. These, would you call them dashboard indicators? Love that.
Yeah,
I think I call them that. A lot. And every time I do, I'll put the little Richard Beck.
You'll mentally footnote.
Yeah, exactly. Dash Richard Beck in my head.
Well, you know, it's one of the reasons why I call it that is like in the book, I focus on those dashboard indicators, like I'll call them transcendent emotions, because a lot of people are like, well, where is God? I don't see God. And it's one of my favorite sermons in the book of Acts, like Paul, and I talk about this in the book, like, up until that point in Acts, he's always been talking to Jewish audiences. So these people kind of know the story of Abraham and Moses and David. But he finally finds himself in the book of Acts, like, with a completely pagan audience. Like, these people don't know about the Ten Commandments. They don't know about Exodus or the crossing of the Red Sea. So he's beginning with nothing. And so he says this: the God who made everything, the harvest and the rain, and he gives you food to eat and fills your hearts with joy. That's the God I proclaim to you. And I love how he uses joy, right? That thing that has been filling your heart with joy for your whole life, as you sat around meals with your family, as you've seen the rains and the harvest, right? That thing that's filled your heart with joy, that was God the whole time. Like, that's the dashboard indicator, right? Pay attention to that. And I just love that, right? I love how he proclaims joy as, like, the map to the divine.
Me too. I was taught that suffering was the most spiritual experience. I think a lot of us were. And because of my particular bent in life, my personality and my story, that became everything, and it became a trap that I got stuck in. And mm-hmm. Now my freedom and salvation is pleasure. I refer to it as the God in my gut, but it's that. It's mm-hmm. realizing that joy, which is a very difficult experience for me. Joy is actually really hard, really complicated. And that's how I know that it's the God in my gut, because it is really hard to get to. And then when I do, mm-hmm. it moves me. It moves. Yeah. I never just stay. I never like experience this transcendent joy and pleasure and then go, everything's the same. Like, it's always movement, which is transcendent, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you talk about eucatastrophe? Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, we've already talked about it a little bit. Yeah, the Eucatastrophe. So there's this famous, most of your people will know J.R.R. Tolkien, writer of The Hobbit.
If they don't know, then they should probably just leave the show right now.
There's some movies out there.
Some movies.
Tolkien wrote this. Wrote this famous essay called On Fairy Stories. I think you can read it online. And it was like a paper he delivered. And in the essay On Fairy Stories, he says, here's why adults should take fairy stories, fairy tales seriously. Yep. And he says many things, but the most important point he makes is the reason why we should take fairy tales very seriously, why they're telling us the truth about something, is what he calls the Eucatastrophe. So the word catastrophe obviously means a sudden bad turn, right? The Greek prefix eu, E-U, is good. So he attaches you to catastrophe. So the you catastrophe is the good catastrophe, the sudden, he calls it the sudden joyous turn. So I think the best location you see this in The Hobbit, I think The Hobbit, where I think it's the dwarves and Gandalf all get treed. Mm-hmm. And the wolves and are underneath and they start lighting the tree. The goblins light the trees on fire and they're completely stuck. Okay. And then somebody looks up and says, the eagles are coming. And so for Tolkien, that's the Eucatastrophe. Things are hopeless. There's no escape. You're at a complete dead end. And then suddenly, right, rescue comes, grace comes. And I talk about the Eucatastrophe in relation to my prison ministry. You guys know that I lead a Bible study in a maximum security prison for about 50 inmates. And I realized in the prison how important the Eucatastrophe is, because in many ways the prisoners' lives, they're like those dwarves in the, stuck in the tree, right? Their lives have reached a dead end, right? They're stuck there. They've made their mistakes. Life is over. And the ones that are able to thrive, not just survive, but thrive, are the ones that who are able to kind of turn outward and receive grace and a rescue that comes to them, that they realize their lives are not over. They're not at a dead end. It's like Ezekiel in the Valley of Dry Bones, where the Lord says, can these dead things live again? And the answer is yes. You know, what you think has no potential, no life, can be restored. And that posture, again, that's a transcendent posture, because the facts look pretty hopeless. But hope is this believing beyond the facts. And I kind of play with that idea through a good chunk of the book, because, again, I think our world has forced us inside of ourselves to look for the answers in our own mess. And a lot of us at some point realize that, you know, I'm just spinning circles in my head. And so the Eucatastrophe is to turn outward in hope or in gratitude. Like, all of these emotions are involve this, what I would call the outward turn. And psychologists kind of know that outward posture is just related to mental health. Yeah. Those people that have it, who are joyful no matter the circumstance, who are grateful no matter the circumstance, who are, you know, hopeful no matter the circumstance, who feel like they matter, right, that they have value no matter the circumstance, those people are thriving. And all of them involve kind of this Eucatastrophe posture, that my joy, my peace, my gratitude, and my dignity and my value are gifts. They're not anything I'm performing for. They're not anything I'm building, but they're received as gifts. And therefore, as gifts, kind of immune to loss. Right? Like, if your value and your dignity is received as a gift of grace, then, you know, when my life falls apart, that doesn't change. If you're grateful no matter what, then when you lose things, you can still be grateful for the little things, you know? And so to me, that's kind of one of the kind of secrets of kind of psychological resiliency is cultivating that posture.
Yep.
I really like that a lot.
Yep.
Thanks for that sermon. I'm just like, I know it's supposed to be like podcast hosting and thinking of what to say next.
What happens when we get together with our friend Richard Beck is that we realize that we're pastors, and when we're with our friend Richard Beck, we finally get to have a pastor for a moment.
That's what it is.
So we end up just going,
that's what it is.
And like soaking up all of your.
Yeah.
So thank you.
I'm starting actually I'm starting to look like Gandalf myself with this beard and my gray eyebrows.
Yeah, do you have a pipe?
I'm your own personal Gandalf.
We accept. We accept the gift.
I need some fireworks and a pipe. That'd be helpful.
Yeah, okay.
You're in a unique position to give insight to this because of the intersection of psychology and religion. I'm gonna state something a certain way, and then you tell me if that's too reductive or if you want to put some meat on it or change it altogether. It feels to me like sort of modern-day psychologists are discovering via research and in the lab sort of the same conclusions that some of the mystics of old intuited maybe in a different way, mm-hmm. Got the knowledge in a different way. Does that work? Is that true?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I'd say the last 20 years, there's been this surge in what's called positive psychology. So for most of psychological history, we've been concerned about the negatives, mental illness, right? So we focus on depression, anxiety, right? Those kinds of things. And the idea was to take somebody who's in a bad state and bring them up to normal. But in the last 20 years, with the rise of happiness studies, research into joy and well-being, there's been this interest in like taking psychological science and focusing on the positive, the things we've been talking about. And when psychologists have done that, focused on the positive, they have found themselves realizing, as you just said, Colby, all these ancient resources. So think about like how something like mindfulness is like all the rage right now.
It's all the rage. Well, and it's thousands of years old.
It's thousands of years old. And so it's just kind of rebranded. But like mindfulness is like the aspirin of mental health. It's like good for everything, you know? It's like if you're just mindful, you just get a lot of psychological and physical benefits. But we've been practicing, all the great religious traditions have some practice of meditation or mindfulness or contemplation. So that's a great example of how those resources and just a simple recognition among psychologists that having a spiritual aspect to life has mental health benefits. Like, it's one of the most durable findings in psychology that people who have a spiritual life tend to be happier. And so where psychologists have tended to not use spirituality a whole lot in therapy like a generation ago, now they're like, listen, if the client brings that to the game, now you would never force that on a client, but if a client has a spiritual tradition, you lean into that because it's a resource that they can use to cope with life.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's in our religious context, we had all things mental health shamed and separate and set aside and said, that's bad. And then in the mental health world, we kind of did the exact inverse, like, and then spirituality is not anything, mock it, or it's not important, or it's not real even. And it's like, oh, both places are just doing the same thing, which is just separating a piece of what it means to be human, which means that you can't find wholeness in either place because wholeness means all. It means bringing all the pieces of who we are. So it makes
no, and I think you're bringing I also have to play fair and be honest here because you're right. Because, you know, I can be selling this thing called transcendence and it's all great and good. But because it's transcendent, you have to use it carefully. Okay. Right. And you have to have trusted people. It has to be a healthy transcendence. And so I kind of talk about some of these things toward the end of the book about and to use biblical language, discerning the spirits. Is this a toxic place? Is this an unsafe place? Is this place using my shame to keep the project going? You know, how's it playing? So And so a lot of people ask me, like, how do you know? And I'm like, follow your joy. Like, if they're leading you with shame, that's definitely not joy. Yes. Yeah. If you're being filled with joy, again, go back to what Paul is saying. That's joy is a compass. If you walk out feeling like this was a life-giving experience, that's a good sign. But if you're coming out feeling bad about yourself or hostile toward other people, again, like Jesus said, like, by their fruits you shall know them. And a lot of the fruits are emotional.
Yeah. Does that when and or if might that lead towards hedonism? And is that a concern? Or is that just a straw man that the uptight
religious?
No,
I think like it's a, again, it's things can swing too far the other way. So if I'm just pursuing my joy, you're right. That at that point, it can become self-indulgent. So there has to also be a critique for that as well. And so what I do in the book is I just kind of use an idea from the theologian Walter Brueggemann called the prophetic imagination. And it's in the prophetic imagination is just that simple ability to feel like the enchantment in your life, that location of transcendent, call it God or whatever. It has at least some moral capacity to call you on your own stuff. Because if you lose that capacity, then you're just kind of baptizing or sacralizing what, like you said, what you want, you know? And there's a lot of that going on in kind of like modern day spirituality where people are just kind of picking and choosing a spirituality that kind of fits their lifestyle and their budget and their values. And that's fine, right? It's just good self-care in a certain sense. Sure. But at some point, is the sacred thing in your life able to kind of say, hey, you should keep your promise. Hey, you should be kind even when you don't want to, right? Like, because going back to what we were talking about earlier about Jesus, right? We love what he does, and yet so few people do it. And I think it's because of this thing we're talking about right here is there's something hard at times about being that loving. And so we need that transcendent thing in our head to kind of say, you can't opt out here, you know, like there's a kind of a, you should do this. And so I think you have to have that piece. That's the piece that I would suggest that would help us keeping the spiritual things in our life from just being another kind of like the religious tinsel we've sprinkled over our consumerism.
Yeah.
Is there some friction there that like that's what the prophets did. They were able to stand up to their own people and say, "Hey guys, you know." So, you know, maybe it's just a voice of conscience in us, but 'cause I know a lot of the things. Like if I was just left to my own devices, I wouldn't be a very great person, you know? And so I benefit from having something in my life that kind of holds my feet to the fire when I'd rather do the easy thing. But you can't swing too far that way either.
That's right. Yeah. Right.
As everything Kate just said.
Yeah.
It's a balancing act.
Yes, exactly. You keep bringing us back to that of the wholeness is what keeps coming to my mind. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about that, and I wonder if, because you said something along the lines of these transcendent things, because they're transcendent, we need to use them carefully, I think is how you said it, like be careful with them. And I'm like, damn that, because all these words you're using for these dashboard indicators, like gratitude and joy, were used poorly in my religious tradition, and then therefore they weren't transcendent, they were almost abusive, and they were definitely not wholeness, right? They were swung one way. So then I realized, oh, one of my dashboard indicators that we haven't talked about tonight, we've talked about all these like really beautiful ones that make us feel good, like joy and pleasure and gratitude, but also grief is one of my dashboard indicators and is a total transcendent experience that if I is not included, then I feel like that's part of that not being careful. Like, oh, just be happy all the time is what joy turns into, right? Yeah. Instead of including the grief and being really careful to be whole, to include it all, right?
Mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah, we can kind of get on our Richard Rohr kick here that we don't want to get dualistic about this, but yeah, holistic here with all of these things.
Yeah. We're always good for a Richard Rohr kick. Yeah, I think religion, when it's operating at its best, when it is functioning well, it offers the sort of what you called holding feet to the fire. It provides some constraint. No constraint is hell. Like, no constraint is, people think that, you know, freedom is just no boundaries, no limits, but that ultimately isn't going to bring, I think, people what they want. So some boundaries, some limit, you know, an artist paints best when they have mm-hmm. limitation. Tell me what colors, yeah. what size of canvas, what, like, limitation there. So I think religion, when it's functioning well, offers that. And then you said it, if it swings, then if it becomes only about that, then now you get into sort of this pharisaical approach where it really is just about following and it's not about the other thing. Kate and I were talking a couple weeks ago, Richard, about one of the ways that we sort of prophetically speak into our own progressive movement of folk, progressive faith folk, is we recognize that sometimes the whole thing can collapse into a single-minded focus on what is referred to as justice. And mm-hmm. everything, justice becomes the defining central and maybe sole point of everything, so that all the other virtues get sacrificed at the altar of justice. So suddenly grace and compassion and forgiveness and kindness, all of those are subservient to this single-minded focus on what justice is. And as you were talking about the way that that sort of can happen within a disenchanted faith, a faith that doesn't have a thing to hold the feet to the fire, that's what was coming up for me, is the way that many of us who have sort of maybe left a version of God behind then don't have a larger container to hold all of the totality of life. And so we flatten it into these one narrow-minded approaches. And I think that's a detriment, I guess, is just really my reflection on that, is it's a detriment to flatten all of the religious spiritual experience into one focus and not have a larger thing to be like, but also what about extending kindness? And also what about grace? And what about mm-hmm. forgiveness? These things, I think, ought matter as well.
Yeah.
No, I agree with that.
Justice, yeah.
Yeah, they're mm-hmm. part of justice. Yeah, well said.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like, I think as America becomes increasingly post-Christian, that our moral, like you were saying, Colby, our moral vocabulary simplifies, and justice becomes the only moral vocabulary we have. And justice does critical things, right? But when all you have is a hammer, everything's a nail. And I think we've seen how just pounding that nail, but when you look at like somebody like a Dr. King, Martin Luther King, who had like a full religious vocabulary, he was able to say justice. He was able to write Letter from a Birmingham Jail and call people out and say, hey, we cannot wait anymore. But he wrote that letter to his brothers in Christ, right? Fellow pastors. And he was also able to talk about love. Well, I don't know if social justice warriors talk about love at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yet that was the, right, King could make that move. So he had a place to go. And the other thing that I think we've seen with cancel culture is like, we don't know how to forgive anybody anymore. You know, like we don't know, like, how to do that. Like, can anybody be forgiven? We don't know. We're just unsure. And so it's just better not. And I'm not saying anybody should forgive, you know, an abuser or anything like that. I'm just kind of talking about, we just don't even know what to even say about that, because we don't have a capacity for forgiveness anymore. So things like love and forgiveness, yeah, typically give you moves you can make outside of justice. And yeah. Kind of going back to Kate's theme of, we need the whole bouquet And when you only have one hammer there, then yeah, things get beat up and other virtues aren't appealed to when you need them. So I think, yeah, there is something missing there. And I think we're feeling it. You know, yeah. I think we're feeling an unease we're really good. We really are good at justice, but we're feeling like we need to make other moves. And without like a richer moral vocabulary, we don't know what to do anymore.
Yeah,
with some of these things.
Yeah.
Which is why I would point many people to hunting magic eels, because I think it returns back. And you provide at the end, what is it? Four types of spirituality. Four chapters. What do you call them? Enchanted, four enchanted Christianities.
Oh, yeah.
Liturgical enchantments, contemplative enchantments, charismatic enchantments, and Celtic enchantments. So I really, again, to everyone who's watching this now or listening back on the podcast, there's a link down in the description of the videos. Please do yourself a favor and get this. Richard, you're a brilliant writer. You're a beautiful thinker. You're a gift to, I don't know anyone else who is as well situated in the fields that you're in, to really offer the gifts that you do. And you do it with such grace and kindness and wit, and sharpness. So thank you. Thank you for this book. Thank you for chatting with us tonight.
You're just one of our favorite humans on planet Earth. So
you two are very kind. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure, you know. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Do you want to take us to lightning round?
Lightning round. All right. Up for it? I mean, no one ever is, so you don't have to be up for it, but we're doing it.
Yeah, I'm a little terrified. Terrified, yep. But let's do this.
You have 5 seconds to breathe. And there you go.
We make it even breathing time over. With effects. All right. Favorite movie of all time?
I would say The Tree of Life. Terrence Malick's Tree of Life.
That is a very, what's the word? Very
nerdy thing. Very nerdy.
No, when people either love it or hate it. What's the word? It's polarizing. That's a very polarizing movie. Yeah. But you are a fan. Are you a fan of McKenna in general, or did that one just really get you uniquely?
No, I'm a fan. I like A Hidden Life, and I like To the Wonder. Yeah, okay. I like what he's doing. I mean, the movies can be long.
Yes.
And I can get sleepy.
Yes.
But I love what he's doing with the camera's telling a story. Yeah.
I love it.
Anyway.
And it's got Brad Pitt, which I'm a fan of.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You said it's polarizing. People love it or hate it. But my memory of that movie was, not sure. That was my response to it.
I think you also slept through half of it.
I had a newborn baby when we watched it.
Why I love it? I love it at the very beginning. You hear the mother saying, the nuns taught us the way of nature and the way of grace. And she then, the whole movie is kind of a meditation on going through life as through the way of grace or the way of nature. And to me, I just find that a beautiful way to think about going through your day is trying to follow the grain of grace every day. So I don't know, maybe it's just that one little scene that has captured my imagination, but I found it really profound. It just affected me.
I love it.
I gotta rewatch it.
All right, yeah. Fill in the blank. Self-care is
necessary.
It's great. I love it. Lightning round. Something you're deeply grateful for right now.
You know, I'm grateful for just kind of my sons. You know, we had them over the holidays for summer, and they're off back to school now. And so it's just good to be with them. So we're empty nested again. But yeah. It's good to have adult sons and have conversations with them, but it's hard to say goodbye. So I'm kind of feeling a little emotional today because we said goodbye to both of them. Oh, my boys. Yeah.
Thanks for sharing.
Oh, my mama heart feels you. All right. Okay, this always gets weird no matter what. So just, like, what are you afraid of? Because trust me, it'll be weird.
Okay. What am I afraid of?
Mm-hmm.
Specifically?
The question is, what's your weirdest fear? But people always just say what they're afraid of, and it's weird. People are afraid of weird things.
Okay. So you want to do my weird fear?
Yes.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm always afraid
yes.
Yes.
that I'm going to, like, so I I have an alley behind my house. There's a fence. I got to take the trash out into this alley. And I have this weird poltergeist fear that I'm going to get out in the alley and like see some like little girl with black eyes and like a nightgown just standing out there. You know, like I'm always like going to turn and see this creepy little girl in the alleyway.
It always gets weird. So,
when he goes outside.
Yeah. That's really weird, girl. I know. But like I try to take out the trash before sunset because I'm gonna see the haunted girl.
Yeah, no little girls.
Way to find a way to work around it.
Yeah.
See, it just always gets weird. Okay.
I am afraid of rodents though. Like
ooh, thank you. Preach.
We had
And those are
we had a traumatic when Jan and I were newlyweds and very poor, we made a bad choice about an apartment. And we had a rat problem.
I gotta go. I won't be able to sleep tonight. Let me know when he's done answering the question.
And we discovered the rat problem because we heard a scratching in the bathroom. And I went in there and I saw it. I kid you not. And I grabbed a 9-iron and I went in there. A rat and me were locked in a bathroom together. And I had a 9-iron. And let's just say, I walked out alive. I walked out alive and the rat did not. I beat a rat to death with a 9-iron. That's how much I love my wife.
Is it safe to come back now?
That's my favorite thing I've ever heard. You're sad you missed that, actually. Your dear friend Richard Beck beat a rat to death with a 9-iron.
Oh. No. I gotta go back and hear that story.
Did you actually unplug? He didn't listen to any of that?
He can't do it.
I saw you do the scratching motion. I'm like, damn it, I'm not sleeping
tonight. He's so scared of rats that he literally will be up all night listening for
I'm
that
convinced
sound.
they'll come to me while
oh,
I sleep.
Oh, no. Yeah. You listen to it. I'm with you.
Yeah.
It's us against the rodents.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm actually so excited to hear your answer to this. No pressure. Who is a famous person? They have to be famous enough for us all, because you're Richard Beck, so you probably have like some obscure famous person.
Like
but they have to be
first cousin.
Yeah, they have to be famous enough for us all to know who it is. Who's a famous person that you swear you would be besties with if only you knew each other?
Barack Obama.
I love it.
I believe that.
I think we can get along. Too. We can get along.
You would.
Yeah.
I can see it.
I don't know why that came to mind, but I feel like we would be good friends. He's intellectual, you know, chill. Anyway, Michelle Obama.
We're talking about.
Yep.
My wife would say Michelle Obama. Oh, she is a Michelle Obama fan.
Couples goals. There you go.
Do you think you'd call him Barry and he'd call you Richie? Do you think it would get to that point?
Barry and Richie.
Probably.
You can borrow his 9-iron.
As we're golfing, I could say, hey, Barack.
Can I borrow
killed
your
rat with a spine? You know.
Okay, what's a book that everyone should read? Doesn't mean it has to be serious. You know, be anything.
I think it's most psychologists would say probably the best psychological book ever written is Man's Search for Meaning. That's the one I'd recommend.
Finally read that this year. Don't know why it took me so long.
You were so impacted by that. Yeah. Beautiful. Okay. Last question that we ask everyone here every week on the Kate and Colby Show. What's sustaining your soul right now? What's keeping you going?
You know, I'm grateful for like being a college professor. I think I got I like being around young people. And so I'm like 54 now. And so it's just like the semester started back. And so I just love being around young people and they in the cycle of coming back and being with them again every year. And so I get older, but they're always, you know, 18 to 21. And that's just been always a source of, I love going back to school just to see them again.
I love that answer.
That's great.
Young people keep that's you going. Great. I love it.
Okay. Friend, thank you again. Thanks for staying up late.
Thank you.
Tell Jana say hi.
Hey, thank you guys. I will. I will. I think she's asleep on the couch.
Yeah, don't tell her in the morning then. That's fine. It's not that urgent.
I could tell her the rat's back.
Oh, God, don't do it. All right, everybody, last chance. Not last chance. You can go buy it whenever you want, but last reminder, go pick up a copy of Hunting Man. And I would recommend Unclean. I didn't, if you, so Richard wrote a book on, I almost said on Johnny Cash. Is that an accurate way? It's like Johnny Cash and the gospel, like
Trains, Jesus, and Murder.
There you go.
Is the name of the book.
The title.
The Gospel According to Johnny Cash.
Yes. So check that out. And then, what's the one after Unclean?
Wasn't the one like about the devil?
Oh.
I wrote a book about the devil. That's a good read.
I wrote a book about the devil.
I did. Right.
I can't remember which one. It was like a
Just
series that you did on your
Richard's
on your
books.
On your blog for a number of years, and then you turned it into a book.
Yes,
and
I know what you're talking about. I can picture it. Yes,
it was
The Authenticity of Faith.
Yes.
No, that was like your first one, right? That was whatever.
Slavery of Death.
Slavery of Death was the one. If you remember, I think I emailed you and I said I'm going to preach and I'm going to quote you because it was so impactful. Do you mind? I adored that work. I adored all your work. So I put down on the screen there, by the way, richardbeck.substack.com. So go sign up for his newsletter.
Because our friend still keeps a blog, right? Do you still blog?
Yeah, me and three other people still blog.
Exactly. I love
all the cool people are doing YouTube shows and podcasts. Like
no,
you.
All three cool people are still blogging. That's how I see it.
All right, buddy.
I love it.
Thank love you. You. Have a good
love
night.
You guys. Take care.
Good night.
Have a good night.
And it was everything I'd wanted it to be.
He's
like
so
you
happy.
Said, he's our pastor. He's our personal pastor.
I don't know if he enjoys that, but
it happened.
We don't get to choose who comes to our churches, okay? Right.
You catastrophized us.
Yes.
With consent, though. Consensual you catastrophication. All right. What do we have coming up next week? Katie
Yay!
Ann.
So excited.
Who's coming?
We have Michael W. Waters, children's books that we have in our home right now that are beautiful.
Yep.
Can't wait to talk to him about those. We've never met Michael. This is another one of our new friends that we'll be meeting for the first time.
Yep.
And the last time we did that brought someone we'd never met before. It was a smash.
Total
hit. So I'm excited. Hopefully we'll keep having that track record.
And then we got John Pavlovitz.
Love John.
Speaking of prolific writers and people that I think understand how to hold justice in harmony with love.
That
guy talks about love.
That is what John does. He talks about love.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yay.
And then Joshua Black. Joshua Black. Have you ever had a grief dream?
I don't know. Maybe I have. We're about to find out.
Joshua Black is the leading researcher in the field of grief dreams.
Leading. That means that there's others. We're about to find out.
And we're going to learn about what grief dreams are and what they might have to say to us and what they might mean. All that and more coming up over the next few weeks on The Kate Colby Show. Thanks so much for hanging out with us tonight. Pod fam, we'll see you eventually. Love y'all. Good night.
Merry Christmas.
If you enjoy The Kate and Colby Show, here are a few ways that you can support us. Subscribe to our podcast feed on whatever platform you use, and when you do, go ahead and leave us a review or rating. This will help others discover our show. Find and follow us on social media using the handle @KateandColby. And speaking of social media, we'd love it if you share our show with your friends. Everyone is looking for a great podcast recommendation, so help them and us out. Finally, if you visit us at kateandcolby.com, you can subscribe to our newsletter, learn more about us, the hosts, and discover great resources for coming more alive. Thank you for your love and support. We do this show for you, our pod fam. Until next time, be well.